3. And at first he was. With the weather as mild as it was, the reception was held outdoors on the castle ramparts, 18 feet wide and bordered by sturdy, 4-foot-high stone parapets. These earth-filled, star-shaped walls, with cannon ports, some empty, some with rusted 17th-century cannons and the points of the stars, surrounded the castle itself, creating a deep, narrow passageway that circled the building on the inside. On the outside, the ramparts overlooked a dry moat, with a wonderful view over Hughtown Harbor, the bright blue-green sea beyond, and the low, mounded green silhouettes of the nearby islands. Kozlov, or a previous owner, had sodded the top of the thick walls so that there was now a rich green lawn underfoot, with a few old picnic tables scattered about, and a well-stocked bar that had been set up for the occasion. Vasily Kozlov, dressed in a bright yellow t-shirt, Bermudas, and sandals, was there to greet them, and to exuberantly embrace Julie when they arrived at the top of the stone steps that led to the ramparts. Striking in appearance, with a short, bouncing, bullet-shaped body and an amazing head of corkscrewed white hair, he looked like Pablo Picasso in a fright wig, a magazine article had once said. He pumped Gideon's hand, an energetic, two-handed grip, and beamed up at him.
"So comes to my house famous Mr. Skeleton Detective. Welcome, welcome!"
"Thanks for having me, Mr. Kozlov. I'm glad to be here."
"Please, please, is Vasily. You come sit in consortium, yes? Anytime, anytime. Talk all you want. What you say?"
"If I do, do I get a discount on lodging costs?" It had made Julie laugh. He thought it might do the same for Kozlov. It did.
"Har, har,"
Kozlov rumbled, reaching up to thumb Gideon on the shoulder and turning to welcome the next of his guests, still chuckling.
"He's funny."
"Looks as if you'll just have to resign yourself to that $20 a day," Julie said. "Come on, let me introduce you to some of the others."
She took his arm and led him toward a group milling near the bar. As they approached, a tall, gaunt man with a gold chain around his neck and overdue for a haircut shifted his highball to his left hand and stuck out his right.
"Hello, Gideon. I'd heard you were coming. It's been a while."
Gideon stopped, puzzled. He freely admitted to being more generally absent-minded than most, but not when it came to people. People he remembered. But this cadaverous, round-shouldered guy with the lined face and the sour twist to his mouth and the gold chain?
It's nice to... he began.
Julie rescued him.
"Why, hello, Rudy. How are you?"
Gideon's heart contracted. This grim, walking ghost was Rudy Walker, the friend of his youth, the man he'd been so looking forward to seeing again? Where was the easy, open-faced smile, the lively, cocky tilt of the head, and the suggestion of good fun just around the corner? He recognized him now, but the changes were very great. It was as if he were looking at a faded monochrome photograph of the full-color Rudy he'd known. It had been more than 20 years, of course, and Rudy, older than Gideon, would be pushing 50 now, but still.
"To see you again, Rudy," he finished, taking the proffered hand. It was clammy, possibly from the drink he'd been holding. "How's Fran? Is she here?"
"Fran died," Rudy said without expression. "She got cancer."
Ah, was that it then? They had been extravagantly, almost embarrassingly in love, Rudy and Fran. Was it her death that had changed him so? It wasn't so hard to imagine. Gideon, too, had lost his much-loved first wife some 8 years ago in an automobile accident. Nora had been the center of his life, his anchor, the reason that he drew breath, and her death had undone him. For one long, terrible year, he was drowning in grief,
unable to come to terms with it. But then, as more time passed, the extremity of his sorrow, of all his emotions, diminished, and he felt himself dwindling into a husk, without aims or interests or passions, isolated from everything and interacting with others by rote. He looked on the outside world as a sort of television set. The power was on, but it was permanently tuned between channels, so that there was life in there somewhere, but it was just static and fuzz, unimportant and without meaning. He couldn't remember, literally could not remember, how it was that one smiled, and when he tried, it hurt his face. And then, astonishingly, wondrously, along had come the funny, pretty park ranger Julie Tendler, and he had thawed, fallen in love once more, and come thankfully to life again. But his meeting her at all had been so random, so unlikely. She had been peripherally involved in the finding of some remains he'd been asked to examine in Olympic National Park. It would have been frighteningly easy to have missed each other. What would have happened then? Without Julie, would he have turned into Rudy? Very probably, yes. Well, without the gold chain, but he'd certainly been well on the way. Julie's hand was still warm in the crook of his elbow. Gently, he covered it with his own.
"I'm so sorry, Rudy. I didn't know. She was a terrific person."
"Yes," Rudy said, managing a small, pinched grimace of a smile. He shrugged and took a double slug from his drink.
"Well, you've certainly come a long way since Madison, Gideon. I followed your career."
Gideon jumped at the chance to change the subject.
"And I yours, Rudy," he said, not entirely honestly. "You've made quite a name for yourself, too."
The truth was, he'd pretty much forgotten about Rudy Walker until Julie told him that he was one of the consortium participants. Then he'd looked him up and found an impressive string of articles and monographs that he'd contributed to ecology journals, popular magazines, and conference proceedings. Rudy had indeed made a name for himself, first as an articulate defender of America's remaining pristine wilderness, and then in a famous, or infamous, Atlantic magazine piece. He'd reversed course and come out in favor of opening up the wilds to roads, cars, and even, talk about anathema to environmentalists, snowmobiles.
"If snowmobiles are the only way to see our great national parks in winter, and mostly they are," he'd written, "then I say let's have the snowmobiles. Sure, they're noisy, sure they pollute, but so do cars in the summer. So do people wherever they go. If the more extreme environmentalists had their way, human beings would be prohibited from our national parks altogether, so that no one annoyed the deer or the bears or the moose or the titmice. But what's the point of preserving a wilderness no one can see? Whose enjoyment are we preserving it for? The titmice's? I don't think so. In my book, people come before titmice." It had turned him into a pariah overnight.
"Quite a name is right," he said now. "I'm the man they love to hate. The whole damn ecology crowd sees me as a traitor to the cause. Yeah, I am an abomination to mine own kind, ever since Black February."
"Black February?"
"The date of the piece in the Atlantic, February 2003. Before then, they loved me, couldn't get enough of me. But now..." He trailed off, darkly shaking his head.
"I know the way it can be," Gideon said. "We gentle academics can get pretty brutal when you step on our pet theories."
"They actually hiss at me at the meetings. Did you know that? Can you imagine? At what are supposed to be scholarly conferences? Sometimes they walk out on my presentations." Rudy had a rigid, skeletal grin on his face. "They wait until I get to the lectern, then get up and leave, all together, just in case I might miss the point.
Gideon lifted his shoulders in sympathy. Over time, that kind of treatment alone would have been enough to sour Rudy, never mind losing Fran.
That sounds rough, Rudy. I don't know if I agree altogether with your position, but I give you credit for sticking to it.
They're in love with the notion of biodiversity, Rudy said bitterly, mostly to himself. It's thought diversity they can't stand.
Well, Gideon said, searching for something to drop into the awkward pause.
How's your little girl doing? He struggled to come up with her name. Little Mary, although I suppose she's not so little anymore. She was only 5 or 6 the last time I saw her, I bet.
But Rudy, festering over his treatment at academia, was jiggling the ice in his otherwise empty glass and looking longingly toward the bar.
Well, look, Gideon said. Why don't we have a pint in town one of these days and catch up, just the two of us?
Sure, that'd be good, Rudy said absently. Well, then,
he smiled that lame, pathetic smile again, and stalked off to the bar.
Sad, Gideon said. Was he like that at the last meeting?
Oh, he lightened up about once every 3 days, but most of the time, yes. Not easy to get to know. I learned more about him these last 5 minutes than I did in a whole week last time. I never knew he had any children. I never even knew he'd been married.
Oh, yes. He and Fran were, well, the way you and I are. I envied them.
He shook his head and sighed.
Come on, I could use a drink myself.
At the bar, drinks were being poured by 2 young women in decorous ye old tea shop uniforms. Shiny, black, mid-calf-length dresses with scalloped white collars, white buttons down the front, short sleeves with pointy, turned-up white cuffs, and little white headpieces to match. Julie took a glass of red wine from the row that had already been poured. Gideon asked for a Glenlivet single malt scotch served neat. At $20 a day, he felt entitled to splurge. As they clinked glasses, Liz came up.
I have to borrow your wife for a minute, she said, drawing Julie off. I need some advice. Girl stuff.
Gideon raised his glass in acquiescence and took a sip, relishing the velvety, peaty flow that warmed him from gullet to stomach.
You like poker?
A voice said into his ear, Vasily Koslov having sidled up to his elbow.
Poker? Sure, sometimes.
It's old tradition here, 10 o'clock in dining hall, every night. Last hand midnight, penny ante, 10 pence limit, 3 raises just for fun, you know? Men's only. Shall you come?
I don't know about every night, Vasily, but you bet I'll come by tonight. Thanks for asking me.
Bring plenty money, Koslov said with a twinkling leer as he threaded off through the crowd.
I got invited to the poker game,
Gideon told Julie when she got back from whatever advice-giving Liz had needed.
I thought he'd ask you. Are you going?
Tonight, anyway. I haven't played poker in a long time. Should be fun.
Are you good at it?
As a matter of fact, I am. I'm figuring on getting that $20 back.
Good luck. They tell me Vasily turns into a shark when he gets behind a handful of cards.
So do I.
Wait and see. I'll buy you lunch tomorrow with my winnings. I'll look forward to it, Julie said neutrally. Oh, and here's the last of our fellows. Donald Pinckney, this is my husband, Gideon.
Happy to meet you, Donald.
Gideon stuck out his hand and smiled, but his heart sank. Another guy wearing a button. But this bright yellow one made him laugh. If we're not supposed to eat animals, why are they made of meat? Donald Pinckney, he remembered, was the pro-hunting voice at the consortium, but he looked about as much like Gideon's idea of a hunter as Joey Dillard looked like an investigative reporter. A tall, balding, bookish man in a crisp blue linen sport coat and bow tie, with mild, seemingly myopic eyes behind wire-rimmed glasses, he seemed like the last person in the world who would willingly be found crouching in a cold, wet duck blind at dawn with a shotgun to his shoulder.
"And I you, Gideon," he said. "I'm afraid I haven't read any of your books, but—"
"What? You haven't read A Structural-Functional Approach to Pleistocene Hominid Phylogeny? I can hardly believe what I'm hearing."
"I need hardly say, however, that it is quite naturally on my must-read list at present," Pinckney said without missing a beat. "But what I was going to say was that I saw you on the Learning Channel not long ago, and was extremely impressed by what you're able to deduce from a few skeletal fragments."
"Only if they're the right fragments," Gideon said modestly. "Fortunately, the TV people had the right fragments. I've read a few of your pieces, Donald, and I have to say you make a heck of a good case for hunting as a positive conservation measure. I'm almost convinced myself."
"I'm gratified to hear it."
"What's your favorite game?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"I was asking what kind of animals you like to hunt. Deer, ducks,
What else did hunters go after?"
"Elk, geese,
"What kind of?"
Pinckney blinked at him, pained.
"Are you serious? Do I look to you to be the sort of man who'd go around with a gun shooting ducks and geese? Let alone gutting them and all the rest of it?"
He gave a small shudder.
"No, thank you."
"But I thought, don't you?"
"Donald is an advocate of ethical, environmentally sensitive hunting," Julie said, enjoying this. "It doesn't mean that he likes doing it himself."
"Any more than I would enjoy electrocuting people, which I wouldn't," Pinckney explained. "Just because I support capital punishment, which I do."
"I guess that makes sense," Gideon said, with enough doubt in his voice that Pinckney felt it necessary to expand.
"I was an administrator with the Pennsylvania Department of Fish and Wildlife for 21 years, Gideon, and in that time I moderated a good many meetings with various lobbying and pressure groups. Against my own instincts, I eventually concluded that, motives aside, the pro-hunting lobby had an extremely sound approach to wildlife conservation, a good deal sounder, and considerably less shrill, than the anti-hunting groups."
He directed a disparaging flick of his head in the direction of Joey Dillard, who was busy proselytizing a small captive audience a few yards away.
"I've been saying so ever since, that's all."
He looked again toward where Joey was holding forth.
"Would you mind excusing me? I feel a strong need to go and correct whatever distortions of reality our earnest young friend is inflicting on those unfortunate people. I'm very happy to know you, Gideon." He nodded briskly at Julie. "Juline?"
There was the delicate sound of a musical triangle being rung for attention, and they turned to see the pale, stately Mr. Morton, standing in front of one of the gun ports, delicately striking it with a metal rod that he held with pinky extended.
Tink, tink, tink.
Kosloff, who had clambered onto the 2 stone steps leading up to the port, waved happily to his guests, arms high, like a feisty bantamweight entering the ring. The sun, setting directly behind him, turned his wild hair into a halo of steel wool.
"Here comes the speech," Julie said. "Remember, you promised."
But Kosloff uttered only 4 words, thoroughly garbled, but full of good cheer.
"Okay, everybody's, let's eat."
"What did the man say?" someone next to Gideon asked. "Was he speaking Russian?"
"No, English," Gideon said. "He said, okay, everybody, let's eat."
And to Julie, "And I'm certainly not going to argue with that." The dungeon was indeed pretty nice, as dungeons went, with coves and niches that roughly corresponded to the castle's star-shaped exterior, and a paramecium-shaped bar in the small, open central area. The rough-finished stone walls bore a clean coat of white paint and were adorned with 18th-century weaponry and navigational equipment. At one end of the bar, a bronze plate screwed to the top said, "African hardwood from the wreck of HMS Retort, sunk by French gunfire off the stones in 1799. Because there was no single space large enough to hold all the guests at one table, people were seated in groups of 3 and 4 in the various niches. Gideon's place was at a table also apparently made from the remains of the unfortunate Retort,
along with Rudy Walker and Madeline Goodfellow, the director of the Isles of Scilly Museum in Hughtown. Earlier, Madeline had announced that on Wednesday, the consortium's midpoint, the museum would be pleased to host a picnic dinner for the participants on Holgate's Green, the pleasant little park at the other end of the village. Kozloff had graciously accepted on behalf of all. The other person at the table, according to the place cards, was Cheryl Pinckney, Donald's wife, to whom Gideon had been introduced at the reception. But her chair was empty. Madeline, a buxom, amiable woman in her 50s who wore her glasses on a lanyard and several rounds of jangling jewelry on her wrist, and who was given to knowledgeable, if somewhat disjointed, prattling, made conversation easy, or rather unnecessary, at first by talking at some length about the history of the castle while the roasted vegetable salads were served and eaten. Star Castle had been built in 1593 by order of Queen Elizabeth, as a defensive response to the Spanish menace, and had often seen action through the centuries. As for the dungeon in which they presently sat, yes, it had been used as a prison for enemy sailors and soldiers early in the 17th century. Later, when the Scillies had become a sort of in-country exile for aristocrats who had got themselves in trouble of one kind or another with the crown, Star Castle had once again served as a prison. But this time its inhabitants, being of a higher class, were usually transferred directly from the Tower of London and lodged, often with their servants and attendants, in the apartments in which the consortium participants were now staying. In 1646, the future Charles II, on the run from the Roundheads, had taken refuge at the castle, and in 1847, Queen Victoria had taken tea in what had then been, and still was, the lounge on the second floor. In 1921, the Prince of Wales, later to become the Duke of Windsor, had lunched. After a while, this subject, extensive as it was, petered out, and conversation slowed to a crawl. What with Cheryl's being absent and Rudy as good as absent. He sat in silence, drawn in on himself like a bird in a pelting rain, moodily nursing his drink and no doubt brooding upon the vindictive consequences visited upon free thinkers who had the temerity to challenge the established orthodoxies of their field.
"And what is your field, Gideon?" Madeline asked with a well-bred show of interest as the salads were cleared away.
She had a fluty mezzo-soprano voice that would have gone perfectly with a lorgnette, Gideon thought with a smile, suddenly realizing who it was she reminded him of. She could have doubled in looks, and even in manner, for Margaret Dumont, that grande dame of the silver screen, whom Groucho Marx had persecuted and punctured with such relentless glee in movie after movie.
"Captain, this leaves me speechless.
Well, see that you remain that way.
Mr. Hammer, you must leave my room. We must have regard for certain conventions.
One guy isn't enough. She's got to have a convention."
"I'm a physical anthropologist," Gideon said. "I teach at the University of Washington."
"No," she put down her wine glass. "Do you mean you know about bones?"
Rudy surfaced.
"Does he know about bones?" he muttered with a laugh.
"Lady, you're talking to the skeleton detective himself." The skeleton?
"I do a fair amount of forensic consulting," Gideon explained. Not for the first time did he wish to hail the reporter who'd pasted that nickname, as impossible to peel off as a stuck-on label from a tomato, on him all those years ago. "Mostly on skeletal remains."
"How totally fascinating."
Her interest now was genuine enough. She pulled her chair closer to the table and closer to Gideon. He caught a strong whiff of talcum powder.
"I wonder, were you planning on visiting the museum?"
"Of course, I'm looking forward to it."
Julie had told him about the place.
"It's your kind of museum," she'd said. "Small, simple, but thorough, nicely done, nothing fancy. You'd like it."
"Any skeletal material?" he'd asked Julie hopefully.
The answer had been no, not that she recalled,
but still there'd seemed enough of interest to occupy him for an enjoyable hour or two sometime during the week. Madeline moved her wine glass over the table in coy, tentative circles.
"Well, while you're there, I wonder if you might... That is, I can't help but wonder. Well, you see, we have some human skeletal remains in storage. There's one set in particular that I was hoping might be of interest to you, a leftover casualty from the Civil War, one of Cromwell's soldiers. They found it 60 years ago, all scrunched up at the bottom of a dried-up well here on Garrison Hill, near the outer walls, costume and all. Well, the costume's been on display ever since the museum opened, but the bones have been stored in the basement all this time."
"Are you asking me to look at them for you?" Gideon asked.
"Yes, if you'd be interested."
"Bless you," he thought. What he told Julie about visiting the local Bronze and Iron Age sites was certainly true. As an anthropologist specializing in prehistory, he couldn't help but be interested in them. But the Sillies had hundreds of such sites, and frankly, one visit to a village consisting of a few scars in the ground and two or three hearth or grinding stones still in place went a long way. If he were down in the dirt with a brush and trowel in his hands, digging away, uncovering the past himself, that would have been one thing. But seeing them as a tourist, just wandering around, pretending to make sense of the plaques, would get old pretty fast, and he'd been wondering just what it was he was really going to do with his time.
"I'm interested, all right," he said.
"There isn't much left, of course, just some arm and leg bones. Still, I'd love to exhibit them with the costume, don't you see? But what could I say about them? I don't know enough about them to say anything interesting. You know, how old he was, or whatever it is that a person like you could deduce. I asked my doctor to tell us what he could about them, but he just took one look at them and laughed. They're probably human and probably male. That was as far as he was willing to put himself out."
Gideon smiled. "Pretty safe guess, considering that they were wearing a 17th-century soldier's uniform."
"Oh, and he also said one of the bones looked diseased. But bones weren't his specialty. You'd think doctors would know more about skeletons, wouldn't you?"
"They do, really. It's just that they know more about them in living people. It's the opposite with me. I'll be able to tell you a lot about a bone found in the desert somewhere. But don't ask me to set a greenstick fracture in some kid who fell off a fence."
"I see," she hesitated. "Then may I take it that you might be inclined to stop by for a few minutes and sort through them sometime during the week?"
"I'd love to," he said sincerely. "How about tomorrow morning? And for more than a few minutes, for as long as it takes, if you like." There were, in fact, few prospects that pleased him more than having an entire morning, an entire day if possible, sitting by himself in some dusty lab or storeroom, with a pot of coffee cooling beside him, surrounded by anonymous fragments of human bone, patiently using Elmer's glue to piece together the skeletons, equally patiently using his education and intellect to piece together the lives of these now forgotten people who had come before. There was a near mystical contentment in it, a sense that he was speaking on their behalf, telling the world for them, "Here I am. I did exist. This is who I was. This is what I did. This is how I died."
"Oh, you dear man, that's super," Madeline shrilled. "We have a few other old bones in our storage room as well, odds and ends mostly, I suppose you'd say. But if you'd care to see them as well..."
"These are what, Iron Age? Bronze Age?"
"Oh dear no," Madeline said. "Any human remains that come out of a prehistoric site go straight to the BM, the British Museum. No, these are simply the odd ulna or tibia that pops up on the beach from time to time. Old shipwrecks and such, don't you know? Not all that unusual, really. People don't know what to do about them, so they get turned into the museum. We keep them a year or two for appearance's sake, and then we quietly dispose of them."
"Ah," Gideon was disappointed, but not very. The older the better, as far as he was concerned. But bones were bones,
There was always something of interest.
"We'd keep them longer, I suppose," she rattled on, "if there were any hope of having them looked at by an expert. But we've never been able to lure one out here to go through them. No context, no skeletal populations of any size at all, do you see? So there isn't much to be learned in any broad sense."
"I understand their point, but I can't agree with that. There's always something to be learned."
"My dear man, I'm thrilled to hear you say that."
She had puffed up with pleasure like a pouter pigeon.
"Are there any tools you'd like me to have there for you?"
"Sure, a metal tape measure and a magnifying glass would be good." He shrugged, thinking. "Oh, and some glue in case there's any repair to be done. Duco or Elmer's would be good, but whatever you use for pottery would do." She nodded.
"I'll have them there for you. And is that all you need?"
She seemed surprised.
"Don't you people use calipers and such? We have both kinds, spreading and sliding."
"Well, yes," he said a little defensively, "if I were doing a really exhaustive analysis. But all I'll be trying to do here is to give you some general idea of who the guy was. I don't think there's much reason to—"
"No, no, of course not," she said quickly. "A general idea is precisely what I want, and I appreciate it enormously."
She chewed tentatively on her lower lip.
"And, Gideon, I suppose I should have mentioned this earlier, but, Hello, everyone, sorry to be late."
Cheryl Pinckney, Donald's wife, had arrived in a cloud of musky perfume and slipped into her seat beside Gideon as the main course of chicken Kiev and rice pilaf was being set out. Madeline smiled coolly at her. Rudy gave her a surly, vaguely lustful nod.
"Just the rice for me,"
she told the waitress, turning her head away from the chicken Kiev as if it smelled bad.
"And some salad, no dressing, oil and vinegar on the side." "Pardon me, Gideon," she said huskily, as her forearm grazed his.
A moment later, a smooth, pant-clad thigh brushed solidly against Gideon's as she crossed her legs.
"Sorry about that," she said casually. "I guess my legs are a little too long for the table."
He had chatted briefly with her during the reception. Cheryl was a nature photographer whose pictures had appeared in National Geographic, Travel and Leisure, and a few airline magazines. If she hadn't told him, he wouldn't have guessed that she was the wife of the prissy, balding Donald. On looks, she might have been a model. With her jutting cheekbones, long nose, and thin lips, no one would call her beautiful, but striking she was, and she moved with a cat-like, self-assured grace that had drawn male eyes to her at the reception like iron filings to a magnet. As far as Gideon was concerned, however, she could have stood to put on a few pounds. On the living, he preferred his skeletons a little better covered.
"As I was saying, Gideon," Madeline continued, "I suppose I should have mentioned this earlier, but I'm afraid we won't be able to arrange anything like your normal fees."
She gave him a fluttery, winning smile.
"If I were to buy you lunch, do you suppose that would do?"
"Madeline, I'll buy you lunch." When the waitress passed behind him with a tray of wine, Cheryl reached over his shoulder for a glass. As she did, a small, firm breast pressed unmistakably against his upper arm, and then stayed there while she spoke to someone at the next table, her arm very nearly around Gideon's shoulder. A few strands of her long, dark hair, held back with a barrette, grazed his neck. This was something that didn't happen to him very often these days. He had long ago learned that he was attractive to women, 6'1", broad-shouldered, with an only slightly middle-aged version of the fighter's body that had seen him through the brief professional boxer's career with which he'd paid his way through graduate school. And the broken nose that had come with it was an intriguing counterpoint to his sometimes pedantic manner, or so he'd been told. All this he knew, but he also knew that no woman had to check his ring finger to tell whether or not he was married. It was written all over him. He was one of those men who emanated husbandly contentment, and women on the prowl were quick to sense his unavailability. He was taken, happily married, and couldn't have hidden it if he'd wanted to, which he didn't.
Still, his forehead was warm as he tried as nonchalantly as possible to separate himself from the undeniably stimulating pressure of that warm, pokey little mound of flesh.
"Now wait a minute," he lectured himself. "What are you getting embarrassed about? You haven't done anything to feel ashamed of."
When Cheryl smiled knowingly and a little patronizingly at him as he shifted gingerly away, he turned grumpy. Now he felt stodgy and old-fashioned, and just plain old.
"Everybody,"
standing in front of the bar, Kozlov was calling for attention. Gideon took advantage of the opportunity to turn his chair still farther around. In doing so, he caught Julie's eye from across the room. She blew him a discreet kiss that instantly whisked away his sulk. He returned it somewhat less discreetly, and Julie gestured something to him. He knit his eyebrows to show he didn't understand. She repeated the message, emphasizing the movements a little. With a couple of tips of her head, she indicated that she was referring to Kozlov and to the welcoming speech that was apparently on the way, then mouthed,
"Be good. You promised."
Gideon bowed his head and placed his hand over his heart to show his good intentions.